The title of my talk tonight is Letters to a White Liberal in a Black Queer Key. Initially, it just said queer key, but then I was like, you know what, why not throw everything that I am into this? Rather than just giving you part, I'm just going to give you everything. One of the participants here, people who came here tonight, asked, you know, what does it mean to talk about things in a Black Queer Key at all? And just by way of introduction of that, when I think about Blackness or Black theology or Black perspectives, what I'm drawing on is a tradition of thought that has largely taken off in the US since the 1960s, known as Black Liberation Theology. And in this realm, it uses the sources that come from Black people's spiritual experiences, as well as their conversation with non-Black writers and European thinkers and theologians, to try to articulate what it means for God to work in our midst to liberate everyone from the forces that bind. Queer theology, in a liberation vein, has a similar trajectory. It looks at the experiences of people who at sometimes are called sex and gender minorities, but really these are just people who happen not to identify as straight or cisgender. And the perspectives of queer people have been historically very rooted in concrete action around anti-discrimination legislation, as well as protections more broadly. And queer thinking over the course of the last, also maybe 60, 70 years, has generated its own sort of theoretical discourse called queer theory. And when you get to take queer theory, your heads will explode. So just know, it's out there, but it's most people kind of date it to 1990 when the term was coined, but since then it has burgeoned into a field that's really impressive, such that our students expect to learn it, which is really exciting because I like to teach it. So as the insights from queer people have entered the mainstream and have challenged former ways of thinking about theology that is sort of, you could almost say, consumed by a heterosexist imagination, more students are saying, I want a future that is not that. I want to see these options. And so that's, now we can almost expect some scholar or group of scholars in every academic department to be able to talk about the experiences of queer people within their syllabi and their courses. So there'll be a bit more to add to that, but I hope that that's a good introduction about what the title slide is about. What you'll see tonight is an examination of the Letters to a White Liberal, which was an essay that was published in Blackfriars in 1963, penned by none other than Thomas Merton. What I want to do is draw our attention to something that he says at the end of that essay. He doesn't end it with a question, but if you reread that essay, his tone takes this inquisitive mode where he's asking for something. And that is what really intrigued me and became the focus of my talk tonight. So I want to talk about that question, Thomas Merton's question. And then I want to suggest that Black scholars and queer scholars have been giving answers to that question that Thomas Merton asks. Then I want to end with some brief summary observations around what the work of Black and queer scholarship and activism has been putting to the forefront of our consciousness as not only people living in the United States, but people living around in a more globalized world. And then invite you all to tell me how badly I did. And ask as many questions as you like, but truly just to invite a conversation about this and to continue the learning posture. Okay? So if you haven't read Letters to a White Liberal in a while, the main idea behind it, imaginatively, I see Merton in the 60s looking at what's going on TV, reading what's going on in the newspapers, and he is very nervous. He's nervous because what he's watching and learning and reading are all pointing towards something that is deeper than civil unrest, but even worse, outright conflict. In the 60s, we started seeing more militarizing presence among white people in the South, bombings of churches, terrorist activities outside houses, black people beginning to march under the example of Dr. King and others in dangerous places, sometimes having fire hoses opened upon them, right? People getting injured. Merton is sitting and listening to what is going on and saying, we're in really bad shape. And Letters to a White Liberal was a letter that was supposed to inspire people who thought that they were on the right side of history, thinking in a progressive direction, but whom he found were not disturbed enough. Because even though they were thinking about history in the right way, they were doing it from the comfort of their homes. They were not marching. Maybe they were even calling for peace, a peace that does not necessarily call for the goals of the civil rights movement, but a cessation of conflict so that we can all sit down at the table and start talking, not asking if that was the tactic in the 50s, which is what was going on, but wasn't working, which is why the Southern Freedom Movement took to the streets in nonviolent protests, right? Merton is watching all of this, and what he is doing is saying, if you believe in equality, why is it not here yet? Why is it not here, and why does it seem that everything is getting worse? Why are the fire hoses out? Why are the police sicking dogs on black protesters? Why are there more bombings if we are all on the right side of history? His letters are a call to action based in a deep theological conviction that the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s is a kairos moment. Kairos, for those of you who haven't taken Greek ever, or in a while, right, is a moment where God's time intersects meaningfully with our time. It's a time of decision. It's a time when it seems that the normal succession of events that go from yesterday to tomorrow is impregnated with something that is denser, more meaningful, the possibility of transformation. This was the moment that Merton saw. And what he wanted to show was that this moment for this Kairos moment was directed at all white people, in particular the white people who believed they were on the right side of things and yet were still horrified by what was going on. Merton, in that essay, his thesis uses language that is both spiritual and psychological in order to say that deep within the psyche of white people in the United States is a fundamental fear, a fear of being confronted with the depth of their own sinfulness. And a sinfulness that issues from the guilty conscience of knowing that the racist treatment of black people, including the horrors of slavery, the indignities of legalized segregation, and the terror of state and extra-state violence that included lynching, terrorism, lack of access to voting, deception, fraud, and wrongful imprisonment. All of that comes from the action of white people in U.S. society. Merton said that is the one thing that white people do not want to show to themselves. And he saw in the movement, specifically the nonviolent movement of the civil rights movement, of the civil rights Southern Freedom Movement, he saw the movement that was led by King as one that was redemptive of the conscience of the United States. And that redemptive word, I think, is meaningfully chosen by him because as you read the essay, one of the things that you will see is that Merton identifies the black people in the United States with the Jesus that he has come to know and worship. Here's a quote for you that I, please work. Yes. So one of the things, and some of this language is outdated. This was written in the 60s. Listen to the language. He says, the sin of the white man, by which he means person, is to be expiated through a genuine response to the redemptive love of the Negro, not from before him. The Negro is ready to suffer, if necessary, to die, if this will make the white man understand his sin, repent it, and atone for it. But this atonement must consist of two things. He says, one, a complete reform of the social system, which permits and breeds such injustices. And two, he comments that this work of reorganization must be carried out under the inspiration of these black people whose providential time has arrived and who have received from God enough light, ardor, and spiritual strength to free the white person and freeing themselves from the white person. You can see a lot of Christ-like language in that. Typically, in the Christian imagination, Jesus is understood to be the incarnation of the divine who comes to make us conscious of our need for God. That as we live our lives in such a way that God becomes so far of a priority that the world that we create in God's absence makes it more miserable for everyone. And so by God becoming human and identifying with the human condition, Jesus becomes one with us and speaks to us like a friend. And like friends, he had a group of people that he really liked. And then there were people, because he was popular, that didn't like him. And the story of his life is one that ends up with his execution by the Roman state. And Christians who become his followers who after and through the present day testify to an experience of this Jesus as no longer dead, but somehow living in them and among them. And as they reflected on Jesus' life and his execution and his stories that he told and shared and the examples that he gave, they began to say that what Jesus' life did, was an offering for the pain and the sin in the world, and that if we begin to believe in Jesus' example and who Jesus said he was, we will find a way out of this world that is marked by the corruption and the evil and the pain that we've come to know. That is a fancy way of saying expiation, which is a word that Merton uses, right? And Jesus, in some imaginations, right, is one who is willing to suffer and, if necessary, to die for the people whom he loves. Merton saw in the civil rights movement, particularly in the nonviolent movement of Dr. King, this same perspective. Now, I think there are dangers to this, right? I think there are dangers, or let's say advantages and disadvantages, to positing that the nonviolent civil rights movement is redemptive in the way that Christ's death is imagined as redemptive. I think one of the biggest worries is that in saying that black people are willing to die in order for white people to understand their sin, we continue to center the experiences of white people and not center the demand for justice for black people, right? I don't think that this reading is inevitable for Merton, but I think it is a worry. I think, generously read, what Merton is trying to point out to us is that if white people are to grow spiritually, they must radically change, they need to take up God on God's Kairos moment, and the occasion for that conversion that they need to undergo are the actions of black people. I think that's what Merton is trying to say generously, that Jesus in his ministry was that moment of decision. What type of world do you want to create? Create the one that I'm trying to bring into existence, right? We call this the reign of God. So Merton generously is saying that what makes the Southern Freedom Movement an occasion of conversion and a Kairos moment is that it is asking and giving white people the opportunity to change, to radically take a new step. But he recognizes too that that is exactly what white people are afraid of. Historically, and this is what he writes, there has generally been no conception at all that the white man had anything to learn from the Negro. And now the irony is that the Negro is offering the white man a message of salvation, more Christological imagery that you can see, right? And that the white man is so blinded by his self-sufficiency and self-conceit that he does not recognize the peril in which he has put himself by ignoring the offer. If any of you students have read Augustine, he might be coming through the back door. I won't go into that. What would it look like for white people to accept the offer, according to Merton? This is exactly where Merton is not really clear. This is the end of the essay that I was telling you about. But he does say this, which tries to gesture in the direction that he wants to go. He says, what is demanded of white people is not necessarily that we believe that the Negro has mysterious and magic answers in the realm of politics and social control, but that his spiritual insight into our common crisis is something that we must take seriously. Spiritual insight are the two words in that quote that I'd like for us to think with and through as I try to talk a bit about some of the black and queer work that has been done. So his essay ends, Merton's essay ends, on a note of hope. Hope that black people will be the ones who will take the reins of spiritual insight and put them to use in enacting a more just world. And this is where the essay ends. Though penned in 1963, this insight is also one of the central theological convictions of what is the nascent field of black theology, which is also coming into existence in the 60s. And one of the most famous statements and original ones of black theology will be made roughly 6 and 7 years later by a theologian named James Hal Cone, recently died in 2018, but known as the founder of black liberation theology. What made Cone so famous, and or pissed off so many people, is that he walked into the scene and said, God is black. Now talk about shaking white people. He walked in to the room and said, God is black, right? And what he also meant by that was something deeply Christological, just like Merton is talking about in his own theology around black existence as offering a Kairos moment to white people. When Dr. Cone said God is black, he said that when God becomes a person, God does not become, like I would become if I were God, a ruler of a vast and wealthy nation where I would have a very easy existence, right? That's what theology gives you. Y'all know that, the money that is just flowing through the doors, right? These are theologians laughing, right? You know, I would not choose to be born in a lower to middle class household in the middle of an empire. Well, a place in empire, a country that's being occupied by an empire. I would not, as we calmly and beautifully sing, you know, in a manger, I would not want to be born in a manger. I would like to be born in a palace. But when, unlike me, right, when God decides that God will become human, God becomes the people, God takes the form of the people who are oppressed. That is what James Cone thought was so interesting about asking Christians to tell him about who Jesus was. Jesus was a person who identified with a group of people who were oppressed, even when God Almighty could become anyone. And when Cone started thinking about the experience of his ancestors and subjected himself to the thought experiment that said, if Jesus were to come back today, what color would Jesus be? Black. Because in the U.S. context, black people were the oppressed. So when Jesus becomes a human being, Jesus becomes black. And if Jesus is God, which is one of the central convictions of Christian faith, you get the marvelously sensational sentence, God is black. Cone took this insight and made it the key theme of black liberation theology. That when Jesus entered the world, he entered it to free people from the chains that bind them. And so Christians need to carry that example forward if they're going to say that they are disciples of this Jesus. And so to say that God is black is to say that God is the one who is being hit by the hoses. God is the one being blown up in the churches. God is the one with the white crosses burning in their lawn. God is the one who has to go to the back of the bus. And God is the one who says, I am black. And Cone wanted to show that Jesus' work that we saw in the Bible is living today in the liberation movements that we see right now, particularly the black liberation movement. And so, the connection I'm trying to make here is to spiritual insight. Allow me to give you three ideas, which I'll put on the screen because I remembered to type them because they're wordy. Liberation theology as a field of study can generally be described as having the central conviction that God's salvific action, that is, what is it that God is offering to us that heals us? God's salvific action takes place whenever people are released from situations of oppression. When you see people freed from the chains that bind them, you are not only witnessing the action of great people, you are witnessing God work through these people as well. Now, insofar as access to this salvific action requires liberation movements to bring it about, one can say that God's salvific action is taking place within those liberation movements. That's the connection that Cone really wanted to make through his work. But then there's more, right? Liberation movements just don't start by accident. They are the work of countless hours of research, of meetings, of one-on-one conversations, of frustrations. They are the basis, if you're doing community organizing, you know, you get one thing done a year in community organizing. That's it. But it's a lot. What happens to make liberation movements work is the inspiring work of intellectuals and activists working together. And that requires intellectual insight. So if God is working through these liberation movements, and these liberation movements require the presence of intellectual and activists working together, then that insight itself is God-breathed, is the mediation of God's presence. And then the final one, am I going too quick for the students? I see these pens moving. I hear you. I gotcha. You want to go back?
I appreciate it.
I teach all day. I know this. You know? When you see the face that says, shoot, they either have had a religious experience or they'll never see that slide again until the midterm. Those are the two options you get, you know. The last thing I'll say is that if this intellectual insight then is salvific, then this is truly what it means to talk about God's salvific action. It takes place on the basis of these insights into what it means to build this world. That's really what's on the last slide. Now, theoretically, this knowledge of God's liberty and activity is open to everyone, right? Cohn and Merton, to be clear, didn't think that they were receiving private revelations from God in their bedrooms or in their while they were dreaming. They thought they were just reading the Bible. They thought that they were just reading the news. This was not a private revelation. It did not require you to go to grad school, get a major in theology, get a minor in business so you can have a job. It didn't require all of this. It just required going to church and learning about Jesus and his ministry. But it is easy, as Merton saw, to have knowledge and do nothing with it. And Cohn, being a black person, said, this knowledge, I cannot survive if I don't put this knowledge into being. The luxury of being white in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 00s, the aught, wherever year we're at now, in case you're wondering where this is going, the privilege of being white is that you don't have to put the knowledge that God is saving everyone into practice. That was what Merton saw. He saw all these wonderful Christians in this country. And he also saw the fire hoses and the terrorist attacks. And everyone knew this was wrong, he thought. What Cohn and other black liberation theologians have impressed upon us is that God's, this knowledge, this spiritual insight, has a particular fervency among those who live in situations of oppression. Why is that? Because we cannot survive without putting this knowledge into practice. We cannot survive as black people in America without having the talk about the police when we get pulled over by the cops. We cannot survive unless we know what side of the neighborhood is the black side and which side is the white side. We cannot survive unless we recognize how precious an education is to avoid prison. So because black people and other people living under oppression have to use their creativity to manage the situations that they live in, not by choice but by necessity, they have the know-how and the insight that Merton and Cohn, I would like to say, thought was so necessary. Merton's question and the answer of black liberation theology comes into connection right here, where when black people speak about what will end our oppression, white people have to listen, because the knowledge of this comes not from book learning, although it's important to look. Yes, everyone. I'm looking at the students again because I love them. Book learning, but it comes from the experiences of our lives. It comes from the experience of living in a segregated world. That was the spiritual insight that Merton said black people had. What black scholars have been doing is trying to systematize what this spiritual insight looks like. That's the connection I want to make with Merton. And in this section, I want to talk a bit about how not only black scholars have been trying to explain this, but also how queer scholars, and I have just a series of black and queer scholars, and also some Latine scholars, whose work has been invaluable in my own thinking about this spiritual insight. So I want to share those with you, and I promise there are pictures. I know I've been heavy on the text, and you know, in the student evals, they always tell you, like, the PowerPoints are boring. I'm like, your papers are boring. Just a joke. See, everyone's awake, so this is good. Mardi Gras, right? We got to say something fun. Okay. So the first person I want to talk to you about is a man named Robin D.G. Kelly, who's a professor at UCLA. And he published a book in 2000, but then it got republished in 2020, consequential year, great year for a new book, where he talks about how the Black Liberation Movement is a movement that is comprised of what he calls freedom dreams. And that became the title of his book, where he talks about the Black radical imagination. He wrote this book because he thought that after looking at movement after movement after movement, he just saw failure. People could look at all these movements, right? And many of us were around to talk about the anti-war movement. I wasn't there for that, but I read about it. Y'all did a good job, right? Y'all were really something. Y'all went to school and you said, we want to learn some things. You know, the anti-war movement, right? I was talking earlier about the Occupy movement. I don't know if any of you remember the Occupy Wall Street movement, but there was one at Yale when I was there, and I loved it. And he said that if you look at what was concretely gotten by these movements, you would just come up with potentially nothing, right? Because when we evaluate statistically what is going on in the situation of Black people, we are still dealing with the same issues that our ancestors were dealing with, right? And so it's easy to kind of say, why care? Dr. Kelly wrote this book to students who he thought lost their imagination to what he calls the cynicism of the market. What did he mean by that? Life is hard and is bad. Might as well just try to get as much out of it as you can. Get that job, you know, maybe reduce your carbon footprint, recycle a bit more, have some kids, do the same thing your parents did, and take out a life insurance policy, don't forget, and then die. That's it. There is no march to liberation. There's only the bell that rings at 9 a.m. whenever the people trade, and then it ends whenever, when I don't know, you know, I don't have money to invest, so I don't know. 4:30, whatever. Let's say that's true. Right. What Kelly is saying in this book is that it's, when you look at movements through these concrete gains, you will miss the one thing that holds all of Black history together, which is our imagination to bring in a world that does not exist. That my ancestors died for a world where I could be talking at Bellarmine University. You can never imagine that, right? And he says these freedom dreams, which exist within the Black imagination through slavery, through Reconstruction, through Jim Crow, through to the present day, are what he says is, quote, ways of envisioning the future, of being together without hierarchy and exclusion, without violence and domination, and instead with relationships marked by love, compassion, care, and friendship. He said, every movement of our Black ancestors has been to bring that world into existence. And he did not want that dream to die out to the cynicism of the marketplace. So he wrote this book as a reminder of what drives us to create the world that is better than the one that we're in. And he said, freedom dreams are the things that do it. And many of his examples in that book focus on the parts of our society that enliven our imagination. If you need to guess, think about the things that are getting defunded right now. Art, right? Music, performance, things that lift our eyes to new moral vistas. He said those are where freedom dreams live. Highly recommend that book. He's one that's really important, I think. Most recently, another person named Vincent Lloyd. Vincent Lloyd is a professor at Villanova University in Philadelphia, which is where I'm from. And he just published a book this year, no, 2022, last year, entitled Black Dignity. And in his work, what he attempts to do there is talk about dignity not as it has been in the past, as a sort of trait that we recognize that other people have. Instead, what Vincent Lloyd is talking about is dignity as manifested concretely within struggles against domination. He says that how do you recognize that someone has dignity? It's when you look at the history of Black people and the fact that they continue to push the conscience of this nation. It is not because they don't have it or that they want it, it's because they have always had it, and it's time for other people to recognize it. Black dignity, he says, is found in our struggle. And what makes this book really timely is that he dedicates this as a philosophy of the Black Lives Matter movement. Another scholar, this one is no longer with us, he died young, Jose Esteban Munoz, not a black thinker, but a Latina thinker. He was a professor at NYU, studied performance. And he started thinking about brownness, he uses this term brownness, in ways that are similar to the ways that black liberation thinkers have thought about blackness. He calls it a source of moral insight. And one of the things that he draws out in a book that was actually published posthumously called Sense of Brown, he talks about that locus of insight. You know how I talked about earlier that the locus of moral insight comes from living under situations of oppression? This is something that he brings out really strongly and beautifully in his work on brownness. He says, brownness indexes a certain vulnerability to the violence of property, finance, and to capital's overarching mechanisms of domination. Things are brown by law insofar as even those who can claim legal belonging are still increasingly vulnerable to profiling and other state practices of subordination. People are brown in the vulnerability to the contempt and scorn of xenophobes, racists, and a class of people who are accustomed to savagely imposing their will on others. Munoz argued that brownness, this experience of vulnerability to domination, provided critical insight to people of color on what he called utopia. Now, it's easy to kind of think of utopia, it means nowhere, for those of you who are following along with other languages that people don't speak anymore. But utopia, he claims, as a place of critical inquiry and critical assessment, where we ask ourselves, why is this world not like this one? And though Munoz was not explicitly a Christian, at least I have not found anything where he says that, he talks about utopia in ways that may have you thinking back to your eschatology classes. Utopia renders potential blueprints of a world that is not quite here, a horizon of possibility. It is productive to think about utopia as a flux, a temporal disorganization, as a moment when the here and now is transcended by a then and there that could be and indeed should be. Two words I'd like to draw from this, which are not in that quote, but I hope you're thinking of. Kairos, moment. And for any of us who have been thinking with Jesus' ministry, when you ask Jesus to, when Jesus has the opportunity to talk about what the reign of God is, the best thing we can do to figure it out is that it seems to be something that is here, but not fully here. Or not quite here, a horizon of possibility. What I've been trying to do in my own work is show these connections among these black and queer thinkers. And that connection is that when they talk about utopia, brownness, or blackness, what they're talking about is the critical insight that people of color have, living under situations of oppression, into the reign of God. And if utopia is a place, and the reign of God is a place, you might have a strong connection there via the Christian imagination. I don't have any good jokes to transition to the next section of the slide like I did last time. But what I do want to provide you with before I open up the floor for some questions are some concrete examples of this happening in black and queer thinkers, with the hope that if you're curious, you can look these people up and maybe start reading some of their work on your own, or even in your own, whatever groups, your study groups that you might have. So hope that this might inspire you to think about these people as interlocutors in Christian conversations, because sometimes these people aren't considered interlocutors. I also want to highlight in this section exclusively the work of black feminist thinkers. For a number of reasons. One is that many people, when they think about black liberation movements, do not think about the women who made the whole thing happen. Women actually, as a general rule, make everything happen in the history of the universe, especially when you study the history of social movements. None of the notices of, I mean, there was no email, folks. People aren't picking up their phones and snapping each other about the march. There were stamp licking, sending the notices out. These were not performed by the men who were too busy, I don't know, doing whatever. And they got it together. They were like, well, we're going to have liberation, but we need to have people, so we're going to send these letters, right? The work of black feminists, black women in this work, particularly black queer women, frequently is so under-celebrated in our thinking. And in my work, I try to make it central, because without these women, there would be no freedom movement. Because no one would be there. No one would know. And also because black feminist thought is some of the most generative thinking when we talk about liberation today. Black feminist thinkers have always thought about freedom, not as narrowly political freedom, like getting the right to vote, like being able to go to the stores that you want to go to, or having segregation ended. That's always been included, but they've been on a whole nother level the whole time. Black feminists and black queer feminist thinkers have always thought of freedom as the project of being able to bring our whole selves into a space where everyone can thrive, where no one has to hide and everyone's needs are taken care of. The freedom dreams of black people in the US have been chronicled, nurtured, pruned, and harvested by black queer women and black women more broadly. So I want to introduce you to a woman. Maybe you might know her. Her name is Pat Parker, and this is her partner, Anne. Parker was a black lesbian poet who died in 1989 at the age of 45. So she died really young. And in her poetry, I see so many instances of the spiritual insight that we've been talking about. Sometimes actually quite beautifully rendered. So I want to give you a small quote from a poem, a much longer poem that she wrote called Group. She writes, "I do not know when my lessons began, osmosis perhaps. The lessons slip into my brain, my cells, silently. I do have memory of teachers. You are heathens. Why can't you be like the white kids? You are bad. Now there are new lessons, new teachers. Each week I go to my group, see women, black women, beautiful black women. And I am in love with each of them. And this is important. In the loving, in the act of loving each woman, I have learned a new lesson. I have learned to love myself." One of the things that I find most interesting about Parker's work in this particular excerpt is that when Cohn thinks about the insight that black people have, it comes from our experience of being and living in a situation of oppression. Notice how Miss Parker learns by osmosis. She learns in a way that is not formally cognitive. Osmosis happens automatically. I haven't taken biology in a long time, so I have no idea. I just remember that's how it happens. That was my one memory. And she talks about osmosis as a process of gaining insight, not only into the racism of her teachers, but osmosis as the process by which she learns to love other people and to love herself. I think there's some critically important insight about what it means to be liberated, that it begins with loving self and loving others. Another person, this one more famous, you might recognize this woman. Her name is Audre Lorde, also with her partner. And in one of her most famous essays that she ever wrote, titled The Uses of the Erotic as Power. And yes, undergrads can read this essay. Don't worry. It's not X-rated. You can just learn from it. She doesn't mean eros in a narrow, like, pornographic way. She uses eros in the way that it enlivens our mind with new perspectives. It is a knowledge, she says, based in where our body's desire for love and relationship lead us. She says, so often in the world, we are told to follow things that do not seem right because they are told to be right, whether those are told by religious authorities or maybe police officers or maybe heads of state. We are taught, to use the language of today, we are gaslit, thinking that what we know is something that we really don't know, even though we really know it. That's what Audre Lorde was talking about in this passage, where she writes, beyond the superficial, which is how people typically dismiss the desire for love that the erotic opens, the considered phrase, it feels right to me, acknowledges the strength of the erotic into a true knowledge. For what that means is the first and most powerful guiding light toward any understanding. And understanding is a handmaiden which can only wait upon or clarify that knowledge deeply born. The erotic is the nurturer or nursemaid of our deepest knowledge. In society, in schools, maybe even going back to slavery, my ancestors were taught that they were less than. That their destiny was to serve white people, or that their destiny was to live a segregated existence, or that their destiny ends in poverty. And yet, that is not what God speaks to black people in our communities. What God is speaking is a knowledge that is deeper, based in love for ourselves and love for our people. And what Audre Lorde is saying is that love is not merely political. It is also deeply embedded in our desire. In the Southern Freedom Movement, sexuality was not strongly emphasized as much as political rights. But what Audre Lorde and other black lesbian feminists were saying is that actually, it's at the root of everything. The reason why black women stamped those letters, protected our children, wanted a better world, and got us educated and made sure we went to church looking good, was because they loved so deeply. And that love carried them. That love sat there. And it was a love that she said did not only lead to loving men, but it led to loving people of the same gender. And she said, we have to bring our whole selves to this, or there won't be a real freedom for any of us. This observation is put into stark relief by another woman, this time a bisexual black poet and activist named June Jordan. She died in 2002. And I love this quote because it's so easy to, like, it makes total sense. You just read it, it just connects so many dots. This is what she says. If you can finally go to the bathroom whenever you find one, but you cannot follow your heart, you cannot respect the response of your own honest body in the world, then how much of what kind of freedom does any one of us possess? I find that this passage just puts a lot of things in perspective. Yes, we need to eat. Yes, we need to go to the grocery store. But yes, we need to love people. And if at the end of the day, I can only bring half of myself into a space, or none of myself into a space, what freedom is there? What freedom is there when we're trapped in shame? That's what she's writing to us about. So those are just three examples of black feminist queer women who have been tremendously helpful in my own thinking. I could talk about them for days, but like I said, it's Mardi Gras and you have some things to do. So what I want to do before Lent hits and we all get back to normal is I want to summarize some of what I think are these central observations that come from the black queer imagination to answer Thomas Merton's question about what that spiritual insight looks like. Okay? The first comes directly from the black queer feminist women that we've just been examining. The liberation of all is always compatible with love of self and others, and others as others who are worthy of equal regard. You don't have to choose between political rights and rights as a lesbian. You can bring your whole self to the party. This statement particularly lived, was not lived, but just was represented really strongly and well in an organization of black lesbians who got together in 1974 and wrote a document called the Combahee River Collective Statement, one of the most famous documents in black feminism, where they wrote this, one of my favorite passages of all time. If black women were free, it would mean that everyone else would have to be free, since our freedom would necessitate the destruction of all the systems of oppression. What a statement. Because what that means is we would no longer be able to hide sexism behind some political agenda. We would no longer be able to hide homophobia around a pro-family agenda. We would have to simply acknowledge that the agenda of human beings is to be free. And when we can let black women, women who are typically forgotten in our halls of learning, particularly our queer black women, when they are forgotten, it's easy to miss out on the part of the world that is most oppressed. Women who are poor, women who are women of color, women who are not straight. And so the Combahee River Collective, in the most manifesto of manifesto ways, just simply says, if we were free, the whole world would be great. Another critical observation. It would mean that the international consensus on human rights would need to become operationalized in our society. Our meaning US. If you're not from the US, you're probably, you know, well, I don't know how you're doing, but in the US, we're not doing that good. One of the things that Black History Month enabled me to kind of return to was a document from 1951. You might be familiar with it. This is the famous document that W.B. Du Bois and others submitted to the UN. And it wasn't a compliment. It was a 100-and-something page document that petitioned the United Nations to sanction the United States in view of its human rights abuses in the area of poverty, schooling, housing conditions, high black mortality, segregation, joblessness, police violence, and disenfranchisement. And here's the other thing about Black History Month. You can even go deeper. 1951 wasn't even the first time he did this. He and other friends of his wrote one in 1946, the same year that the Human Rights Commission started. They were on it. We have to take human rights seriously. In our country, we have this perspective that the United States law is the supreme law, and we do function that way, sometimes internationally with that perspective. But I think one of the things that black thinkers have been calling us to think about is we are in a world together. It is not about the United States. No black liberation movement has only been about the United States. All the black intellectuals that you know as the Black Panthers, Malcolm X, I mean, these were all international figures. They all traveled to China, they traveled to Cuba. They were all over the place inspired by the liberation movements in those countries. When we tend to think about freedom as simply this US project, we may be more likely to think that we are hopeless. But when you look outside of our country, you see successes and you see challenges, but you also see immense creativity unleashed, and black thinkers learned from them. Huey Newton went and learned from the Chinese what was going on, brought back knowledge to use in the movement. So having an international perspective is very important for us, that the plight of black people in the United States is not that separated from black people around the world. And I think that gives us some inspiration, especially when we look at the movements that other people have launched, as well as a challenge when we notice so much devastation still by black people, or not by black, but to black people living in Africa and other places in the diaspora. Third, we have to start taking the notion of reparation seriously. Taking seriously the question to repair our past, to make atonement for our collective past. This is one of the things that Merton thought white people did not want to do. If he were alive today, you talk about reparations to white people, that's the quickest way to get the elevator door closed in your face. They're not holding it for you. No one wants to talk about reparation. But the reason why is because when some people hear the word reparation, they hear payout, which, let's not be confused, money is involved. But I prefer, and the Black Freedom Movement has not preferred to talk about reparation as payments, because those don't repair. Payments do things, money does things, but that's not everything. I'd like to just highlight briefly Ta-Nehisi Coates, also a famous black intellectual living in France. If you study black history, we all go to France at some point. Just, he's there. James Baldwin was there. I get it. I need to go. All right. And this is what Coates says. He says, reparations, by which I mean the full acceptance of our collective biography and its consequences, is the price we must pay to see ourselves squarely. So when people resist the very notion of reparation, what black people hear is, you don't want to talk about the past and the truth that would be required, the truth telling that would be required, to tell our story fully. And I think if Merton and Cohn were alive today and we're looking at what is going on in Florida around curriculum change, let's be polite, I know I'm being recorded, so. You know, where critical race theory is seen as anti-American. Critical race theory, by the way, which we've been doing all night. All of you have been now critically raced. You all have now fallen under the spell. Go right to DeSantis. We are just telling the truth about our history. That's what it means to repair. And then what comes from that is a new human community, a better one, maybe connected to utopia, maybe connected to the reign of God. Genuine opportunity. I use the word genuine opportunity because people love to talk to me about opportunity and I don't know where they think they see it. So I want to make sure that if you see opportunity, I'm going to make it genuine. Genuine opportunity means that we have to talk about our life chances in this world. This is more critical race theory, by the way. When we step back from thinking about racism as this interpersonal interaction among good at bad actors, right? Where person A, generally a white person B, a black person, are in interaction, and person A does something intentionally to disadvantage person B on the basis of race. When we get rid of that notion of racism, not rid of, but at least put it to the side for now, and just start thinking like scientists and say, let's take some factor in the world and just look at how it's distributed on the basis of race. That's critical race theory. That's also called studying systemic racism. And I will only give one statistic. There is a racialized wealth gap that is staggering. So what I mean by, I know some of you might be doing theology, so you don't know about math. I don't know about math, so I looked it up. Here we go. Median. This is not the average. Jeff Bezos and the Tesla dude and all these other people are not skewing the white people. They're not in it. The median is the middle number that separates the top half from the bottom half. Oprah isn't skewing it for black people. Obama isn't, like no one. This is the median number. For white families' wealth, which is assets, right, is $188,220. When you're going through a pandemic, that is what we call a nest egg. However, if you are black going through a pandemic, which I know is theoretical, the amount of money that we have in a household is $24,100. That's wealth. Also not skewed. That middle 50%. In 2021, the poverty line for a family of four is just $2,400 more than that, at $26,500. So when you're going through a pandemic, what resources do you have? And as many of us know who maybe take sociology classes and have studied this, what we find is that wealth correlates with a number of things. It correlates with health, it correlates with education, it correlates with attainment. And so by denying that this racialized wealth gap is the result of generations and generations of accumulation and devastation on both sides, right? If we deny that, we will continue to see poverty increase, particularly as, all of us may know this, right? More and more of the wealth in this country is being concentrated into the hands of a very small number of very wealthy people. And another important concern of black people have been the numbers of our people who are living most or a significant part of their lives behind bars. The criminal justice system in the United States locks up more people than some of the countries in the world that we commonly talk about as repressive. In the US, we lock up 664 people per 100,000. That's in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Russia, our favorite ally, that's a joke for the future that hears this, 329 per 100,000. China, 121 per 100,000. And Iran, probably regarded as one of the most repressive regimes on planet Earth, 228 per 100,000. The story that I can't tell tonight, but that is one that needs to be told, is that the number, what explains the rise in our incarceration rate is not violence, it's drug crimes. And even though white and black people use illegal drugs at equal rates, which is something I know college students are like, yeah, duh. I know no one here, just in my college. Black people are the ones who get locked up for it. So in this final conclusion, I want to talk about that spiritual insight that is worth not dying for, which is what I think Merton was so, what found so moving because it was Christologically important to him. But in the Black Liberation Movement, it's the spiritual insight that is worth living for. It's worth organizing for. It's worth not giving into the cynicism of the market for. And I want to end with, like I said, one of the most photogenic people I've ever seen as a priest. You knew I had to show one white person in order for this to be legit. I mean, this is the Thomas Merton lecture, so I wanted to make sure y'all got it. All right, here we are, you know. Merton believed that this work would not only help the goal of human rights work, which we've been talking about, but that it would also make the Catholic Church a place that is truly Catholic. And by truly Catholic, I mean universal, worthy of the name of saying that it can be a spiritual home for all people. Merton writes, "A genuinely Catholic approach to the Negro would assume not only that white and the Negro are essentially equal in dignity, but also that they are brothers in the fullest sense of the world, on the word, sorry, not world. This means to say that a genuinely Catholic attitude in matters of race is one which concretely accepts and fully recognizes the fact that different races and cultures are correlative. They mutually complete one another." What Merton is rejecting here is a version of Catholicism that says if you want to be Catholic, you need to be essentially culturally white. that if you want to be Catholic, you have to think of the organ as this only divine instrument, that you have to listen to Marty Hogan forever and ever and ever. There are some Catholics in the room. Okay, good. See, that got you, right? Good, right? He says that to be a genuinely Catholic church, we have to be a church of correlation, connection, of complementarity, that white and black people need each other, not to become one or the other, but to show the diversity of God's beautiful earth. The only addendum I'd like to add to that tonight is that when we recognize that black people are gay, cis, trans, fat, thin, differently abled, Latino, yes, we're even European, the list can go on. But when we recognize that black people are all of these things, then Merton's words are prophetic. Because what Merton is calling for is the inclusion of all of us. Thank you.